Welcome to the third Johns Hopkins Alumni Book Club of 2010. I'm Jay Lenro, graduate of the class of 1973 and an officer of the Alumni Council. We are here in the San Martin Center on the Homewood campus in the new home of the Office of Alumni Relations on a picture-perfect late spring afternoon. Less than 2 weeks ago, the university celebrated its 134th commencement ceremonies on Homewood Field, where President Ronald J. Daniels conferred degrees on 6,323 graduates after hearing an inspirational talk by New York Mayor and Hopkins alum, Michael Bloomberg. It is a pleasure to introduce our faculty host, Professor Katrina McDonald of the Sociology Department. She will discuss this month's selection, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates, by Wes Moore, a graduate of the Krieger School, class of 2001, and a university trustee. Mr. Moore recently appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show on April 27, 2010, where he discussed his book, and where, by the way, Ms. Winfrey gave every member of the audience a copy of the book to take home. Dr. McDonald holds the title of Associate Dean of Multicultural Student Affairs and Associate Professor of Sociology. In 2006, she became the second Black female ever to be awarded tenure on the Homewood campus. She regularly teaches on the African American family, race, racism, and racial privilege, researching race, class, and gender, qualitative research methods, and introductory social statistics, to name a few. She serves on the board of the Center for Africana Studies and is a member of the Hopkins Diversity Leadership Council, the Maryland Humanities Council, the American Sociological Association, the Hopkins Population Center, and the Hopkins Black Faculty and Staff Association. Her recent book, Embracing Sisterhood, Class, Identity, and Contemporary Black Women, analyzes how contemporary Black women's ideas of Black womanhood and sisterhood merge with social class status to shape certain attachments and detachments among them. In collaboration with Dr. Caitlin Cross Barnett, Dr. McDonald has recently crafted new research on contemporary marriage among African Americans. She is also collaborating with Professor Pamela Bennett for a study of minorities in the military. The book we will be discussing today is an engrossing tale of two young fatherless men and their mothers who, while connected by name and neighborhood, show how family support, character, inner perseverance, personal responsibilities, choices, and good fortune led one Wes Moore to become a Rhodes Scholar and White House Fellow and the other Wes Moore to become a convicted murderer. Please welcome Dr. Katrina McDonald.
Thank you.
Dr. McDonald, obviously, you and I had the chance to speak a little bit before we started today. And what was particularly of interest to me was the fact that not only are you intimately knowledgeable about the book we're reviewing, but our Wes Moore was, in fact, one of your students and a mentee, not only during his time here at Homewood, but also at his time at Oxford, and that you've kept in regular touch with Wes since then. It would appear that the perspective you have of watching Wes grow from that young man from Baltimore through his years as an undergraduate and watching him blossom must have been particularly fulfilling for you to watch someone so gifted start to fulfill his potential.
That's certainly true. Wes never took a course from me, but I remember him being introduced to me by another student. I think it was one of my graduate students, and I was immediately impressed with him as a person. He was just very soft-spoken, very respectful. We just clicked immediately. and made a point, you know, to connect with each other anytime we could and to share whatever was going on. And he just struck me as a young man who, in telling me his history, had just overcome so much. And I was just so proud to know that, you know, that he had come to that point, which was fairly early, and then to see him graduate eventually and go off to Oxford. I remember that my favorite moment was when he emailed me from Oxford and said, you know, you're not going to believe this, but one of my good friends right now is Chelsea Clinton. And he says, but, you know, when we go out to the pubs and stuff, everybody thinks I'm her bodyguard. He says, they don't even assume that we're just friends. And I just, the picture of that was just hilarious to me. But I thought, what privilege to be able to, you know, to meet her and learn about her father through her and all of that. And then eventually he ended up in D.C. You know, it just seemed like things unfolded as they should be with him. And I put him on a pedestal, I have to admit. I think he's one of the most amazing young men I've ever met. I hold him in great esteem. And when he told me he was working on this book, I was first taken aback, thinking, oh boy, he's taking on such a challenge, because I know how hard it was for me to write. But it was very clear that he was motivated to do something that was so dear to him. And so to hear that he had put together this project where he was laying these two men side by side was really fascinating. I got to read an early draft, and I knew it would be a special project in the end.
Well, reading the book and reading about Wes, I think it's fair to say that it was an honor for Chelsea Clinton to get to know him also.
I know, it's true.
Just one comment on the book stood out to me. Mm-hmm. This is from former Senator and Secretary of Defense William S. Cohen, who said, Wes Moore is destined to become one of the most powerful and influential leaders of this century. You need only read this book to understand why. Mm-hmm. When you have people like that, or Ben Carson, Juan Williams, Tavis Smiley, who writes so glowingly about you, you can see why you immediately took to him and became his friend.
Well, I certainly applaud Oprah, who happens to be, you know, I'm a major fan of hers, but I love how she gives people a stage, and she knows what she's doing. She knows how she's opening up the world to that person, and I'm so delighted that he had the opportunity to let the world know who he was on her stage. I think it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Let's start out talking a little bit about the book. Mm-hmm. Are there, you know, why don't we look at some passages that you believe really are representative of the author's writing, and discuss why you personally chose those as representative passages.
Sure. I'm not sure that people would necessarily agree with me that I picked the most representative. I think it's very subjective. But in this one passage, I was really taken aback just by the last sentence. And it's something that I've carried with me, and I will read it for you now.
Yes, thank you.
It's fairly early in the book. It's in, I'm not sure what chapter I'm in here. Chapter 2, actually. The very, very last two pages. He says, and I think this is a theme that runs throughout the book, when did you feel you'd become a man? West asked me, a troubled look on his face. I think it was when I first felt accountable to people other than myself, when I first cared that my actions mattered to people other than me. I answered quickly and confidently, but I wasn't too sure of what I was talking about. But when I did, I actually became a man. When was it I became a man? There was no official ceremony that brought my childhood to an end. Instead, crises of other circumstances presented me an adult-sized responsibilities and obligations that I had to meet one way or another. For some boys, this happens later, in their late teens or even 20s, allowing them to grow organically into adulthood. But for some of us, the promotion to adulthood, or at least its challenges, is so jarring, so sudden that we enter into an unprepared and might be undone by it. Wes, feeding off my answer, attempted to finish my thought. Providing for others isn't easy, and the mistakes you make trying are pretty unforgiving. He paused. I waited. He rubbed his chin softly, pulling at the long strands of his goatee with his fingers. And second chances are pretty fleeting, he said. What do you mean? From everything you told me, both of us did some pretty wrong stuff when we were younger, and both of us had second chances. But if the situation or the context where you make the decisions don't change, then second chances don't mean too much, huh? Wes and I stared at each other for a moment, surrounded by the evidence that some kids were forced to become adults prematurely. These incarcerated men, before they even reached a point of basic maturity, had flagrantly and tragically squandered the few opportunities they had to contribute productively to something greater than themselves. I sat back, allowing Wes's words to sink in. Then I responded, "I guess it's hard sometimes to distinguish between second chances and last chances."
That's a fascinating, introspective comment. So much of the book seems to be our Wes viewing his path, mm-hmm. and almost pondering why him, why he ended up where he is, and when he could perhaps easily have been the other Wes. Mm-hmm. But as you noted when we were speaking earlier, there is so much innate to an individual that determines whether they're going to succeed or not. You can have two children raised in the same family by the same parents, mm-hmm. the same schooling, and end up very different places.
Sure.
But that probably is one of the more introspective comments he has in the book.
And it's not clear if the question is really being put to one or the other. I mean, I think the question is one that either of the men could have offered, in a sense, you know? I think that a lot of young Black men, I think a lot of Black folks in particular, lean on what I called an old kind of Christian antich, which is there go I, but by the grace of God, you know, the notion that I could have been any one of those people. As I'm walking down the street and I see the prostitute and the drug addict or the wife beater, whoever, and say, that could have been me. But God somehow chose that I be safe from that. And whether you truly believe that God intervenes in that way is not quite the point. The point is in recognizing that you're not as privileged as you may think. You're not as protected as you think. You know, yes, you can look at yourself and say, you know, I was able to avoid it. But, you know, it just takes, you know, a turn of a dime in a certain situation to have led you possibly into that same pit. And it's a powerful moment. I've had them many, many times, you know, when I've looked in the face of a young Black girl. And I'll tell you a story. I remember when I was in graduate school, I was in my second year, the beginning of my second year, and I was very pregnant. And I was walking across the campus and stopped cold in my steps. And I said, oh, my God, I'm having a Black boy. What was I thinking having Zach? Just the very idea that I was going to bring a Black boy into the world and I was going to have to get that boy to age 21. You know what I mean? It was frightening as all get out because I knew that it wasn't just going to be about what I did for him that was going to get him through. It was going to take a lot of people giving him the positive vibe, directing him, you know, and I had to pray that they would come, you know. It was very frightening for me to raise a boy, and I did a foolish thing. I went to the movies to see Boys in the Hood, a very popular movie in the early, mid-80s, I guess that was, late 80s. It's a movie about L.A. gang culture and about one boy who gets through, who eventually goes off to college, a boy and a girl. And again, I came out of the movie theater. My son was maybe 18 months old, and I came out just weeping. And my husband just couldn't console me. And eventually he said, Katrina, what's wrong with you? And I said, we have two Black boys. You know, I had my stepson and my child. I kept thinking, how are we going to get them safely through? And so the journey for Black boys is really tough. And we're always joyous to see the ones that get through. And it isn't necessarily because of their poor choices, you know. They try to make the best choices they can often, and somebody trips them up and tells them they can do something they're not supposed to do, or whatever it be. Mm-hmm. But for parents, I think it is really, really challenging. And you have to have a lot of faith that it's going to be okay.
And just think about that. You and your husband, two highly educated people, being concerned about that.
Scared to death.
And imagine what it's like to someone who never finished high school, who with a son who never really knew his father, mm-hmm. living in poverty, and how much more, if it's frightening for you, how much more frightening must it be for them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. And by that I mean, on the one hand, as a sociologist, of course I understand, you know, what effect social class can have on the opportunities and choices available. I understand that perfectly. But I also understand that those people, for instance, who don't have as much education also don't know. They don't know what the pitfalls are. You know what I'm saying?
They don't know enough to be afraid.
Right, in some ways. And they just go through life doing what life does, getting up in the morning and cooking eggs and going up. They don't necessarily see what could be lurking around the corner other than the most obvious dangers, you know? Mm-hmm. I grew up in poverty myself. It's poverty then is a little different than poverty now. Poverty in the early 1960s and into the, I grew up mainly
wasn't
in the 70s.
Dangerous.
It wasn't the same kind of poverty, you know. I wasn't mired in it. It didn't hold me back. It made my mother worry about whether we were going to eat things like that. But it wasn't. I mean, I was still a very active girl in my church and in school, and I did well. I was a straight A student because my family made it so. The family made it so, despite the little that we had. Poverty wasn't as fearful because it didn't come with gang violence. It didn't come with drug addictions. It didn't come with all those other things. It was just poverty, you know. Today it's a whole different ballgame because I worry about children who have to deal with such things in their homes every morning before they go off to school. It's hard for me to imagine. I've never been in that position, but I can't, you know, I ache for the children who have to navigate that just to get out of the door to show up at school on time. You know, that's a whole different ballgame. Yeah, we may have had some drunk folk back in the day, but it's nothing like we're experiencing today.
Is there another passage that particularly moved
you?
Yeah,
this is a shorter one, and I just thought it was cute in a way. this is the other West speaking, I believe. And it says, he spent the next 7 months building his daughter's house from scratch. His little daughter. He sandpapered every board, hammered every nail, leveled every edge. When it was finished, the house stood 5 feet high and arm's length across. It included shutters, a door, and windows. It was by far the most complex project in the group. And the group being he was being trained, you know, in the prison to be an artisan of some sort. When it was finished, it sat in the display room along with the projects of his classmates, including wooden plaques and a plain box that someone called a telephone base. To Wes, the house was more than just a project to complete. It was a daily reminder of why he was there. These past months have been the most important and enjoyable in Wes' life. He learned skills, gained confidence, and finally felt his life could go on in a different direction. He stayed at the Job Corps Center so he could provide a better life for his kids. He stayed for his mother, who had sat home watching Tony, his brother, continue moving in and out of the criminal justice student. He stayed at the Job Corps Center for himself. So this is the other Wes, you know, who took the simple things and tried to make them count. Unfortunately, you know, he didn't get the benefits that the other, our Wes friend did. Mm-hmm. But in that passage, you know, you really see him trying to structure his life in a way that could help him succeed. And what may seem simple to the rest of us was obviously very huge for him.
Well, one of the other common threads was the lack of a father in the home. And I thought the day after he appeared on Oprah Winfrey, our Wes was mm-hmm. was interviewed by NPR. Mm-hmm. And he was talking with Michelle Norris, who raised the issue of fathers, and said, is it a key for boys to have consistent authority figures, also guides in their life? I guess that what I was thinking about, because your father died when you were very young, mm-hmm. but he was there in the very early years, not so for Wes, the other Wes. And our Wes's response, I thought, was fascinating. He said, absolutely, yeah. And you know, there's actually a part in the book where Wes and I are talking about our fathers. Mm-hmm. And he'd said something that I think is very true when he said, you know, your father isn't here because he couldn't be. My father wasn't there because he chose not to be. And therefore, we're going to mourn their absences differently. And boy, that's not a telling comparison. And showed, I guess, reading that, it made me even sadder about the other Westmore, because it showed that here's a young man who obviously was too bright to have ended up where he was. He had some, you know, just that statement indicated that he had some real insight. And maybe it, as you said, came too late for him. Your line about the second chance versus the last chance. And but it showed that he did have some true insight.
Definitely. He certainly analyzed that nicely. I teach a course on the African-American family. And actually, this past semester was one of the best classes I had in 14 years or something. I just thought I had a great group of students. And, you know, always our conversations end up, it seems, you know, pondering this concern about the lack of black men in the lives of women and in the roles of father. It is an issue that really, really haunts, I think, the community. I think that young people today are adamant to turn it around, to be honest. I see signs of it. I unscientifically, I should say. I have observed young couples getting married earlier than they did 20 years ago, and I'm reading that as them trying to prove I can do this, that, you know, I can do this, and I can have children young, and I can stick with them the whole time, and I can, you know. And I'm hoping that, you know, if not the 2010, the 2020 census shows some change there. The absence of fathers is very, very potent, and it's been difficult for me as a staunch feminist, you know, to claim that men, you know, really make all that difference. You know, we've talked about that. And I'm sure some
You'd have to ask my wife about that.
Well, some of that for me, I know, also comes from the fact that I've never had a father. You know, I've never known my father. And I don't know whether, of the two responses to why fathers, and, you know, I don't know which one applies to me. I don't know if he didn't want to be with us or couldn't. I don't know. And for many, many years, I didn't care. Because I had a fascinatingly loving family. I was well taken care of by my mother, my grandmother, and my aunt, and my cousins. I mean, I never felt a loss. Not until I had my son, you know, and he began to say, do I have a granddaddy? You know, and I felt like, oh my God, I don't have an answer, you know. And so then I became keenly aware of the significance that a father can have, even having not had that experience. And I certainly knew I wanted for my son, so I've worked very hard since he was a baby to help nurture the relationship between him and his father. And I did marry his father. We're still married today for 16 years. But the father figure is huge, especially for boys, I think. Especially for boys. I think girls and mothers go together in ways that you would think. Not that all girls get along with their mothers, but I think there is a bond there that's unique as bonds between boys and fathers. At the same time, you know, I know of black men. This is just my terrible bias. But black men who adore their daughters, you know, adore the daughter, father-daughter thing too. But it's different. It's a little different. You don't think of black girls so much strain as a result of their poor relationship with their father. But you see boys kind of falling off the cliff, you know. So we have to be careful. And even as I talk about the differences between boys and girls, they're not that vastly different. Now, I mean, we're concerned for both boys and girls as they relate to their fathers. But we know that in a home, boys need to understand what manhood's about. And women can't always tell them. We try, but we don't always.
And, you know, with your sociologist background, one of the things that just kept running through the back of my mind as I'm reading Westmore's words were, you know, I was just drawing comparisons to survivor guilt, to those people, you know. One of my wife's dear friends worked for Marcia McLennan, and the day of 9/11, their offices were in one of the towers. he had taken his daughter to school, and it was a pretty day, so he just decided something he had never done before. He decided to walk to work from her school.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I can be a little bit late. Well, every one of the 43 people who reported to him died.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And for the longest time, he had that mm-hmm. survivor guilt. And so that was going through the back of my mind, and our thinking how R. Wes Moore,
mm-hmm.
as he's going through this, is really has some similar types of thoughts.
No doubt. I think I saw some of that in Wes as I knew him years ago. I mean, not that he would talk about it or lament it, but there was just something about, well, he had to have said something, but something led me to believe that that was certainly something he carried. And the other boys he hung out with that I knew were similarly that way. I think just about any black boy who's in college feels that way. You know, realizing that they're one of few. It's rough. I think for me it came up, again, when I was in graduate school and pregnant, I was doing research on young pregnancy. So I was doing a lot of qualitative interviews in the homes of pregnant women, a lot of round women. And there was this one Hispanic girl, young, 17 or so, who was pregnant. She had an African-American boyfriend who was kind of, he was pretty abusive to her. You know, wasn't the best guy, but she loved him and all that. I spent a lot of time with her. I was just really drawn to her. So even outside of the work of the research, I would see her. And I was struck again one day cold when I realized that, oh my God, is she looking at me thinking it's going to be able to survive this? Here I am, a PhD student, making $50,000 a year. I have a home, a car, insurance. I have all the things that make possible for me to be a mom. And she didn't. And I freaked out thinking, oh my God, am I sending her signals that this is, you know, that it's going to be, I just freaked out. I suddenly thought I was a horrible role model, you know. Again, feeling, knowing that I would survive this, not sure that she would, you know, was rough. So I certainly know the feelings of survivor guilt. I've had them in other contexts. Again, I think, almost every African-American who's made it anywhere feels it at some level.
Are there any particular issues that you think is going to spur our readers to get into a really good discussion online, back and forth?
I don't know.
I mean, ideally, what would you like to see them debating?
Talk about? you know, it's funny. I think people who know Baltimore well, we'll debate whether or not he captured, you know, the reality of Baltimore City well. I was fascinated by a lot of the passages that got you to really paint that picture of Baltimore life. One of my favorite ones is Chinkapin Elementary School and them calling it Chicken Pen. And I found out people still do. I mean, that wasn't just something back then. My son, I said it to my son the other day. He goes, Mom, you didn't know we called it Chicken Pen? I didn't know, but I thought that was hilarious. You know, I think people will debate whether he captured Baltimore accurately in his story, because Baltimoreans care very much, particularly those who've lived here all their lives. I don't know if you know how territorial Baltimore, but black Baltimoreans are. They're very about the east side and the west side, and you know, and
yeah,
I'm
they
sure
don't like each other, the east side and the west side.
Yeah, I mean,
sometimes.
I'm not sure how genuine that he is, or it's just in fun, but it's potent, you know. And so I think some of the debates that will go on, you know, are people who know the city, and they'll be debating whether they think he captured the reality of the city accurately. I felt he did a pretty good job, though. And then there was the reality of something else. Let me think, what was I going to say? Oh, let me just say this. I was a little taken aback, and I would say this to Wes if he were sitting here now. I was a little taken aback by the detail he was able to give in some of these historical passages, you know, about when, you know, let's say it's the other Wes Moore, and in the book it's a description of him coming in contact with this person and this happened. I'm like, how do they remember those details? I mean, it's very detailed, and I don't know that I could remember that much detail. You understand what I'm saying? I'm not denying the ability of someone else to, but I just found it, I was fascinated that in talking, and the two men talking to each other, that they could draw out such specific detail of encounters they had with each other, being chased down the street by this mean kid or whatever. I mean, it was so vivid, and it was all recall, you know? It was just amazing.
There's another passage in Wes's interview with Michelle Norris, and he said, when you start your day reading a letter from someone who is going to spend the rest of their life in prison, when you start your day like that, it really helps you to think about your day. It humbles you. And I do think about the blessings that I had, the family, and I do feel like I'm lucky and I'm sincerely thankful for it, which ties into everything we've been discussing.
Yes.
Is there anything else that we haven't touched on you think the readers would be interested in knowing about this book?
Well, I think people will, in some ways, want to know more about his motivation. I mean, in one way, it's kind of obvious. You know, you meet somebody with your same name, and you have an opportunity to pick their brains and try to, you know, reconcile for yourself. How did I not end up there? You know, but beyond that, people might ponder the other part of the motivation. Is there a larger intent? You know, the way he ends the book with a particular epilogue he does. You know, he clearly feels strongly about helping to divert tragedy among other young black boys. It is almost like a call to judgment in terms of getting people up and ready for this fight. I know that myself, I'll tell you what, you know, one of my fantasy projects is. I mean, I think, again, I worry about children who get up every morning and could do fascinatingly well, could be a Westmore tomorrow if they had the right environment. And I'm fascinated with the notion of urban boarding schools. Absolutely fascinated. Wish I had the money today. Because I think that being able to school children who are in difficult situations in a boarding school with great educators and great social workers and great other adults who love them, but keeping them fairly close to their communities, not taking them out somewhere in the country in a boarding school way, but keeping them in their cities, but having an environment where together those children learn how to support each other, how we're going to get up every morning and make sure our rooms are clean, you know, how we're going to make sure that our homework gets done together. I mean, that collective thing is fascinating to me. So this book kind of reminded me of some solutions out there that we need to give some serious thought to. Now, that's not a novel idea on my part at all. You know, this is, I can't think of the gentleman's name right now, but there are two brothers, I believe, who started something very close to that in Washington, D.C., and they recently have put together the school in South Baltimore, I believe, that they hope to eventually include a residential section. I'm fascinated by this idea because I think it is the answer. I think it is the answer to helping children who are in dire circumstances with negative influences in their homes, whether it be their parents' alcoholism and drug addiction, or brothers, you know, being involved in the drug market. If we need to get the kids out of that environment, we need to put them in a loving environment where they can still have contact with their families here and there, but where they're there focused on maturing, you know, and learning how to be independent, all those kinds of things. I'd love to see urban boarding schools pop up all over the country, and I really think we could turn this thing around.
Ideally, what would you like to see the readers come away with when they read this book?
Well, yeah, I don't think you cannot come away with the feeling of gratitude for those of us who are succeeding. You know, just amazing gratitude that I did not fall under the pressures that this world has to give. I think there'll be some shame in thinking about the times you got away with it. You know, all of us have done things where we know that had I not just done this and that, that situation could have been my situation. I could have been pregnant at 13. I could have been this. I could have been that. And you can't help but to be grateful that it didn't happen. I mean, that's how I feel when I read it. For those who are still suffering who might read this, you know, I just pray that the book helps them to understand what circumstance is, that you can be brilliant and successful in the midst of mess. You know, it can happen. I think there are some people who won't get this book because they wouldn't have really experienced either side at all. You know, they may not fully appreciate it, I think. But for those of us who have touched on success and touched on, you know, dire failure, I think can appreciate the book for the hope it brings. I mean, I think Westmore himself is one of the most hopeful people on the planet. You know, he's just, I love him so because is so positive all the time, and he's so giving all the time. And I don't want to put too much pressure on him. I don't want him to feel like he owes the world too much, because he is a single man, an individual man, and he does need to live for himself and breathe, and you know, because now he's on this big stage, and we know what big stages can do to people. So I pray that he stays grounded. So I guess, you know, perhaps if nothing else, people will get to know that this man exists in the world, and they'll be happy to know that there's somebody out there who's tender enough to tell the story and to want to help people have hope. You know, that no matter how bad things can be in childhood, you can choose to press on into great adulthood.
Thank you, Professor McDonald. You've given us a tremendous amount to think about. To our participants, I'd like to remind you that during the months of June and July, Professor McDonald will be posting about 6 questions on the website for an online discussion. And don't be surprised when she chimes in and leads the discussion one way or the other as she offers some of her own insight. I'll close by just saying, I understood what you just said about not having personal experience with Wes's story, but I couldn't help think about the universality of this. If you're in a family other than the fairy tale family, where every, you know, from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are good looking and the children are above average, for those of us in the real world, you know, we've seen in all our families people who have faced more challenges than others. Mm-hmm. And it might not have been the exact same challenges as the two Wes Moores, but they are challenges indeed. Sure. That everyone faces. So thank you. This has been fascinating.
Thank you.